Thursday, July 8th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Evidence emerges of the airborne spread of COVID-19.
We have spoken about the importance of all of the different potential modes of transmission.
Is African wildlife paying the price with their lives for the pandemic killing tourism?
Some of the jobless community members have turned their spears against the wildlife as much as.
Also ahead, former Beatle Ringo Starr celebrates his 80th birthday with a twist on an annual tradition. It's all on today's International Edition. The number of confirmed coronavirus cases in the United States rose by over 50,000 on Tuesday, pushing past 3 million and stoking fears that hospitals may quickly get overwhelmed. This as President Donald Trump pushes states to open. Cases continue to surge in a number of states, including Florida, California, and Texas, which reported its biggest one-day increase since the pandemic began. The U.S. has the highest known numbers of both COVID-19 cases and deaths in the world. Meanwhile, new information is emerging about how the virus is transmitted from person to person. World Health Organization COVID-19 technical lead Maria Van Kerkhove talked about it at Tuesday's briefing.
We have been talking about the possibility of airborne transmission and aerosol transmission as one of the modes of transmission of COVID-19.
The WHO has previously said the virus spreads primarily through small droplets expelled from the nose and mouth of an infected person that quickly sink to the ground. Also Tuesday, the UN confirmed it received formal notification of a decision by President Donald Trump that the U.S. will withdraw from the World Health Organization. Joining us now is Dr. Ravina Kular, infectious disease specialist and an epidemiologist with the Infectious Disease Society of America. Before we get to the latest on the pandemic, what's your reaction to the U.S. withdrawing from the WHO?
I mean, this is the time in the midst of a pandemic that America needs to join with the global scientific community to really fight the virus. And we cannot do this alone.
How big of a deal do you think it is for the United States in general to be withdrawing its affiliation with the World Health Organization? Obviously, nothing's perfect. The World Health Organization has issues it can improve on. It seems like a pretty big deal.
It is. I mean, without the World Health Organization, us here in the U.S., we're going to be at higher risk of being inadequately prepared for many health risks of this pandemic and really not being able to get access to these vaccines and therapeutics, I think it really makes us very vulnerable.
Also, the World Health Organization has been talking more about potentially updating how COVID-19 can be transmitted from person to person. And one of the things we have heard a lot about is droplets, but now they are saying that it can potentially be airborne.
Several publications have shown that the virus spreads through singing, speaking loudly, or breathing heavily, which leads just the scientific community to question, is it just respiratory droplets or is it airborne? And so the World Health Organization is looking at this data to see whether there might be airborne spread of COVID-19 that's happening here just because of this emerging evidence that's happened. What we're seeing is that as businesses reopen around the world, as people consider gathering in closed indoor spaces with poor ventilation, we're getting more of a complete picture of how this virus actually spreads.
Would that make a lot of things that we thought were okay to do potentially not okay? Would that have health officials and leaders of nations and cities rethinking how they go about protecting people?
It would. I mean, you look at other airborne pathogens such as tuberculosis, measles, where it makes it very highly contagious. It would make us really be mindful of opening businesses, maybe slowing down opening up these businesses until we really have a firm evidence, is it really airborne or not? I mean, we're seeing a very similar picture to display that airborne hypothesis with these closed environments. So it would take a step back in any progress that we've made with businesses opening.
It's pretty serious here in the United States. We have not flattened the curve. In fact, the curve seems to be going in the wrong direction. And it also appears that it's not limited to any specific location of the country, but it's pretty widespread at this point. Where do you think we're heading? And I know you are in Los Angeles. California is seeing a pretty big surge right now. Tell us where you think this is all going and what you're seeing from your vantage point there in California.
I think we're knee deep in the first wave of this pandemic. You know, if you consider coronavirus as being a wildfire, we humans are the trees or the fuel. So states are now allowing people to put themselves in closer proximity to others, and the fire can more easily jump from one person to another. And so that's why we're seeing this situation is arguably even worse now since the virus started. Here in California, what's happening is that there are many mass gatherings of younger people, which are gathering in pool environments and house parties by the beach. And so we're seeing a resurgence of cases, and some of the hospitals being overloaded, the ICU, the emergency room with these younger people, as opposed to the beginning of this COVID-19 pandemic, there were the older folks that were being affected. So you're seeing people laxing and taking off their masks, not socially distancing, not really worrying about hand hygiene, and just, almost considering there is no pandemic happening.
We've been hearing a lot about the so-called silent spreaders, too. You're saying that more young people are now being impacted, but also aren't they also potentially responsible for many of the cases we're seeing now because they have no symptoms?
Correct. This virus is quite sneaky in the fact that there are these asymptomatic carriers that can easily transmit their virus without knowing it onto others. And I think that's what we're seeing here.
What do you say to people who are unable to deal with the fact that they've been at this for 4 or 5 months now, and there is really no answer to when they'll be able to go back to any semblance of normalcy?
I think we need to keep in mind that we're still in a pandemic. We have to avoid crowds. I know it's summertime. That summertime just makes us all want to gather with our friends, but we cannot have a loosening of practices here. We have to keep in mind we're in a pandemic setting. We have to put on our masks, avoid these large gatherings, keep a social distance to really fight this pandemic, because right now this virus is winning and we are slowly losing day by day. You know, we're in the first week of July and the U.S. has reported its third largest daily case totals. That's very, very concerning.
Dr. Ravina Kular, epidemiologist with the Infectious Disease Society of America. Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro, who has spent months minimizing the severity of the pandemic, told reporters Tuesday that he has tested positive for the novel coronavirus. It has killed more than 65,000 people in Brazil, the world's second worst outbreak behind the U.S. Saudi Arabia has one of the highest coronavirus infection rates in the Middle East, with more than 213,000 confirmed cases and nearly 2,000 deaths as of Tuesday, prompting the custodian of Islam's holiest shrines to restrict the annual Muslim Hajj pilgrimage to a small and limited ritual event in accordance with safety guidelines. But as Dale Gavlak reports from Amman, analysts expect that scaling back the pilgrimage will also deepen the kingdom's economic slump.
The U.S. Embassy in Riyadh has been helping organize special flights to take American citizens, including embassy staff and their dependents, out of Saudi Arabia as coronavirus infections sharply increase. Early on, the kingdom took strong measures to try to contain the COVID-19 pandemic. But as Middle East analyst Theodore Karasik at Gulf State Analytics tells VOA, there were other mitigating factors at work in the country of 30 million.
In Saudi, it was more of a lockdown. But Saudi Arabia, that's large and kind of porous, and various levels of individuals within the society, they move back and forth across borders. And so the disease is kind of harder to control. There were outbreaks just because one or two people who were infected went to go visit someone else and ended up infecting the whole family. The other area getting high rates of infection is amongst the migrant workers.
Karasik has also worked professionally in containing pathogens and devised the United Arab Emirates Business Continuity Strategy for disaster management. He says the Saudi authorities recognized the danger posed to grand mosques in Mecca and Medina and closed them right away. Now the Saudis are permitting a very limited Hajj pilgrimage at the end of July compared to the more than 2 million pilgrims from over 180 countries who normally participate. Pilgrims will be made up of 70% residents of Saudi Arabia and 30% Saudi citizens. Saudi officials say health workers get priority. No one who is not already inside Saudi Arabia is allowed to enter the kingdom for the pilgrimage. Many had feared the pilgrimage, which packs colossal crowds into small religious sites, could be a massive source of contagion, Karasik says.
The Hajj will be done mostly internal to Saudi Arabia. The way that revenues work in Saudi, particularly with missing the Hajj, is going to be, of course, financially damaging to them. But they will squeeze their belt and go through this process because at the end of the day, the custodianship is more important than revenue.
In normal times, analysts estimate that the pilgrimages add $12 billion, about 7%, to Saudi Arabia's GDP per year. They say that between 25 and 30% of the private sector's income in the Mecca and Medina areas rely heavily on the pilgrimage season. The International Monetary Fund expects that Saudi Arabia's GDP for 2020 will shrink by 6.8% as the coronavirus pandemic and low crude oil prices take their toll on the economy. Despite that, Saudi Arabia is pressing ahead with a $20 billion mega-tourism project in the capital, Riyadh, hoping consumer spending will rebound once the virus abates. Del Gavlak for VOA News, Amman.
Uganda's wildlife authority say the halt to tourism income from COVID-19 is pushing many people who depended on tourists into poaching the very animals the industry depends on. Uganda's national parks reported a doubling of wildlife poaching during the pandemic compared to this time last year. Uganda's conservationists are looking for alternative income sources for the communities to stop the poaching. Halima Athumani reports from Kampala.
Between February and June of this year, the Uganda Wildlife Authority recorded 367 poaching cases across the country, more than double the 163 cases recorded during a similar period in 2019. John Makombo, the Uganda Wildlife Authority Director for Conservation, attributes the increase to the COVID-19 lockdown, lost income for people who work in the tourism industry, and inadequate human resources to cover all the conservation areas. Tourism is usually Uganda's leading foreign exchange earner, reaping $1.6 billion in the 2018-2019 financial year alone. But with the closure of the tourism sector due to COVID-19, Makombo says the tourism sector is not taking in any money, making the national parks vulnerable to poachers.
That loss of benefit has led to job loss and unemployment of many stakeholders. Some of the jobless community members have turned their spears against the wildlife as poachers.
The most recent incident was the killing of Rafiki, a beloved silverback gorilla in the windy, impenetrable national park in southwestern Uganda. Gladys Karemazikusoka is founder and chief of conservation through Public Health, a non-profit wildlife group. She says most gorilla killings are accidental, but killings of other animals are not.
They set snares for other animals that they want to eat, like a small antelope or a bush pig. They'll go for those to eat them. And when they set these snares, gorillas can accidentally get caught in the snares. But worse still, we've had cases of people spearing gorillas, yet they were not going for gorillas, they were going for duiker and bush pig.
According to Uganda's Tourism Act, 20% of all revenue collected in national parks is directed to local communities, including $10 of all permits from Windy Impenetrable National Park. In the current circumstances, however, that money has dried up. Kalima says to cut down on poaching, her organization and the Uganda Wildlife Authority have started an enterprise where farmers are given an above-market price for their coffee.
These are farmers who we engage so that they don't have to go into the park to poach to be able to feed their families. We're encouraging them. We're trying to see how to get them seedlings for fast-growing food so that they can at least eat. They're not starving while they wait for tourism to come back. These local communities, I think, they can coexist with wildlife, but if they're hungry, it's very difficult for them to coexist.
According to the Uganda Wildlife Authority, wildlife in Kidepo, Lake Mburo, Makshon Falls, and Winnie Impenetrable National Parks remain vulnerable despite efforts to enhance patrols around protected areas. The authority is ensuring its rangers spend more time with the gorillas which are the main attraction in the parks, to lessen the chance that they could wander off and be poached. Halima Athmani for VA News, Kampala, Uganda.
Here are some of the other stories we are following at VOA. China is forging ahead in the race to develop a vaccine to help control the COVID-19 pandemic. Sinovac, biotech's experimental vaccine, is set to become the country's second and the world's third to enter final stage testing later this month. The U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency announced Monday that foreign students must leave the country if their school's classes this fall will be taught completely online or transfer to another school with in-person instruction. It's not clear how many student visa holders will be affected, but foreign students are a key source of revenue for many American universities. And a U.S. envoy has arrived in South Korea in an effort to renew stalled nuclear talks with North Korea. The arrival came just hours after the North issued a statement saying it has no intention of sitting down with the United States and told South Korea to stop meddling. France's newly appointed government gets down to work this week, facing big challenges, including coronavirus and the economic crisis, not to mention general elections in less than 2 years. Lisa Bryant has more from Paris.
Proposition du Premier ministre. Le président de la République a nommé.
The new government takes office just over a week after President Emmanuel Macron's Republic on the Move party fared poorly in the second round of local elections. Heading it is Prime Minister Jean Castex, a little-known former mayor from the Pyrenees. He earned the title of Mr. Déconfinement after managing France's emergence from the coronavirus lockdown. He replaces the popular Edouard Philippe, a possible challenger to Macron in the next election.
President Macron has one goal, to fight the recession, to transform the country, to do the reforms in order to be in a better shape than now for the next presidential election.
Ulysse Gosset is a political commentator for France's BFM TV.
The job of the new prime minister is to execute the orders from Macron. He has to deal with the crisis and no more. Macron doesn't want a prime minister who could be a competitor like Edouard Philippe, the former prime minister, was.
Making more waves is the new Interior Minister, Gérard Darmanin. At 35, he's the youngest Interior Minister of France's Fifth Republic. He takes over at a time when the police force is demoralized and faces allegations of racism and brutality. Darmanin himself faces a preliminary investigation into a rape accusation, which Macron's office says didn't pose an obstacle to his appointment. Police unions have offered a muted reaction to their new boss, but some feminists protested in front of the Élysée presidential palace. New Justice Minister Éric Dupond-Moretti is also controversial. He's earned a reputation as a pugnacious lawyer defending Corsican nationalists, African politicians, and WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. One judge's union leader slammed his appointment as a declaration of war against the judiciary.
Je mesure pleinement la charge qui est désormais la mienne, qui est désormais la nôtre.
Macron's reshuffled government faces heavy pressure to take environmental action after the Greens party surged in municipal elections. The new Minister for Ecological Transition, Barbara Pompili, co-founded an environmental party and was a former Secretary of State for Biodiversity. But she isn't a big name, and she'll face close scrutiny in how she handles emissions reductions and other green goals. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
The Commission of Inquiry on Syria will launch its latest report on events in Idlib and surrounding areas. The report focuses on rampant human rights violations and war crimes. It will be submitted to the UN Human Rights Council later this month. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Syrian and Russian forces launched a military offensive late last year to retake Idlib province and surrounding areas, the last remaining territory under the control of armed groups in Syria. In its report, the UN Commission of Inquiry describes the suffering endured by Syrian children, women, and men during the military campaign as unfathomable. The report documents 52 attacks by all parties to the conflict between November and June. Commissioner Hani Megali says hospitals and medical facilities, schools, marketplaces, and residential homes have been attacked. He says civilians have been killed and injured, infrastructure damaged and destroyed. He speaks by video link from New York.
Within that, we found that war crimes were committed, were likely to have been committed by both the Syrian Air Force and by the Russian Air Force. We document two incidents in the report where we think it was Russian airplanes that conducted those attacks. And we explain why we think it was the Russians rather than the Syrians.
Megali says the report lists other types of war crimes committed by both pro-government forces and by the armed groups and terrorist organizations. He says they include indiscriminate attacks against civilian populations, the use of cluster munitions, and deliberate attacks on protected objects.
We've come to the conclusion that the attacks by the pro-government forces were so systematic and designed to force the population to move. And the forcible transfer of populations is a crime against humanity. So we think that, again, may have happened. And both by pro-government forces and by armed groups and terrorist organizations, we've seen pillaging and looting happening, which again are war crimes.
UN investigators report more than 1 million people, 80% of them women and children, are displaced and living under dire conditions near the Turkish border. They say they face an uncertain, grim future, further complicated by the COVID-19 pandemic. They say those Syrian civilians need sustained and unfettered life-saving humanitarian aid, as well as assistance in tackling the looming threat of the pandemic. There has been no official response to the report from the Syrian government. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
VOA's International Edition continues. A new species of seaweed threatens to take over a sensitive environmental area northwest of Hawaii. As VOA's David Byrd reports, the seaweed is killing vast swaths of coral and threatens a once pristine area.
Researchers first discovered the seaweed at the Papahanaumokuakea Marine National Monument in 2016. It was not widespread, and so scientists noted its presence, but didn't do much more. In a similar survey last year, however, researchers found the seaweed, which scientists dubbed Chondria tumulosa, is now covering several thousand square meters of the pristine reef. The reef was devoid of fish, and fish that usually eat algae were not attacking the new seaweed. Allison Sherwood of the University of Hawaii is the lead researcher on the project.
Last summer, in 2019, they went back up and they were resurveying in these areas, and they found that this alga had increased incredibly in abundance. So all of a sudden, it was at this abundance that was very alarming, overtaking large parts of the reef at Pearl and Hermes Atoll.
Scientists don't know if the seaweed was brought in from elsewhere, grew on the reef naturally, or was always there, and then conditions became right for its rapid spread. Adding to the distress, the seaweed has a unique tumbleweed-like shape that appears to easily detach and spread to other reefs. Allison Sherwood says the nuisance seaweed is now acting like an invasive species.
It's very alarming to find that there's something that is behaving like an invasive species. This is a nuisance seaweed, and we don't have a name for this alga. That's rare. You don't typically find something coming into an environment and causing this level of alarm and simply not knowing what it is or where it might have come from.
Peter Mumby is a coral reef ecologist with the University of Queensland in Australia. He says when a coral grows next to seaweed, it is an energy-consuming battle for space, sunlight, and nutrients.
They take up space that otherwise would have been available for a baby coral to start growing and form the next generation. And so they kind of usurp space, and they're very good at that because they can grow very rapidly.
Randall Kosaki is the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration Research Coordinator at Papahanaumokuakea Marine National Monument. He says a top priority is to make sure that the seaweed doesn't make its way to the main Hawaiian islands, either by accident or on purpose.
If something like this got back to Waikiki, or anywhere in the main Hawaiian Islands, it would be a ecological disaster, but also an economic disaster. You can imagine what that would do to tourism, to have an algae like this overgrowing the reefs.
For now, researchers plan to continue mapping the seaweed and to study its molecular makeup. They hope to develop mitigation strategies and later find a way of managing the seaweed spread. I'm David Byrd, VOA News.
Former Beatles member Ringo Starr celebrated his 80th birthday Tuesday by hosting another Peace and Love birthday festival. In past years, Starr has held live events around the globe, including in New York City's Times Square, in Nashville, Los Angeles, Hamburg, Germany, and Nice, France. But this year, due to the COVID-19 pandemic, the program titled Ringo's Big Birthday Show went virtual. The annual tradition began in 2008 in Chicago, when an interviewer asked Starr what he wanted for his birthday. He replied, more peace and love. Starr marks his 80th birthday following another Beatles milestone. In May, the Beatles' final album release, Let It Be, turned 50 years old. You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Gungani, I'm Lori London in Washington. Thank you so much for listening. Have a great day.
What's going on, Africa? This is Jackson Vunganyi coming to you from the Voice of America studios here in Washington, D.C. Join us each week on Upfront as we discuss a range of topics. The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
Eliminate the mentality that girls cannot do what boys can do.
You basically need to go to school. There's just no way you're going to get all these skills that people want from you or they expect from you if you're not at school.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Can't AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Releasing American citizens who have been unjustly held against their will by foreign governments is a top priority for the United States. So far, more than 40 hostages and detainees have been brought home since President Donald Trump took office. In June, Americans celebrated the release of U.S. Navy veteran Michael White from Iranian custody. Mr. White had been wrongfully detained in Iran for almost 2 years. The United States negotiated and secured his release with notable help from the Swiss government. As part of the agreement between the parties, charges were dropped on Majid Tahiri, a Florida dermatologist who had violated U.S. sanctions on Iran. At a press briefing, U.S. Special Representative for Iran, Brian Hook, said that such a successful diplomatic outcome on the consular level builds confidence that the United States and Iran are able to negotiate agreements that advance the interests of both countries. There is no question that if we could reach an agreement, a comprehensive agreement, it would advance the interests of the Iranian people. They are very tired of seeing their national wealth squandered in places like other countries in the Middle East and also in places like Venezuela. He pointed to the benefits a new deal would bring to Iran, including lifting sanctions and restoring diplomatic and economic ties. Special Representative Hook noted that Iran has so far declined the opportunity for deeper dialogue and engagement. Because of this, the United States has pursued a threefold policy toward the Iranian regime: maximum pressure, diplomatic isolation, and the credible threat of military force to defend U.S. interests. That policy, Mr. Hook declared, has denied Iran's leaders money for their malign activities. It is also the way to advance the president's goal of bringing them to the negotiating table. The president has had the door open for diplomacy for many years, said Special Representative Hook. A new and better deal will certainly benefit the people of the United States and the people of Iran. And so, the door remains open.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.